just make a couple of announcements before we move forward. So as I was saying at the beginning, this is our first program for Torah in Motion in Israel. I want, first of all, to welcome you all. We're thrilled that you're here. In fact, there's so many of you here that my innate pessimism lost the battle because I schlepped over 50 photocopies of my talk from Canada in hard copy, thinking that would be way too many. But it turned out that it was too few, and so I definitely apologize to everybody who did not get the source sheet. And I will attempt, if you wish, to get one to you at a later date. I wanted to spend a minute talking about what we do in Torah in Motion. We are an organization that has brought in many, many, many speakers from around the world, and our philosophy is that the modern world has to be taken very seriously because it has many challenges for Jews and many opportunities. And we stress honest, open, free conversation. We like our events to not be frontal. We like them to be horizontal, where people can talk. And we want people to come away having a better sense of how they think about their own religious practice, their own views, beliefs, how they fit sociologically. And we try and be as unafraid as possible of any topic that we're talking about. I commend you all to go to our website, which is torahinmotion.org, and to view our extensive, well over 1,000 MP3s. In the last 5 years, I've done panels and interviews with many people in the Jewish world on many topics, and I think you'll all find it extremely beneficial, and we hope you sign up on our email list. It's free. You just get what we're doing. And given that my family and I are making Aliyah this summer, we are going to be running increasingly more events in this country. I know that there are a lot of events that go on in this country, and I know the usual attitude to doing anything in Israel is it's already been done, but we will see what we can do. It's my pleasure this morning to introduce our three panelists. To my immediate right, Rabbi Dr. Avi Berkowitz is on the faculty at Hebrew University and is the rabbi of the Minyan HaMayan Synagogue in the Rimon section of Efrat. Next to him is Rabbi Francis Nataf. Rabbi Nataf is a Jerusalem-based educator and thinker and the author of three books of contemporary Torah commentary. And my far right is Dr. Moshe Kapel, who's the professor of computer science at Bar-Ilan and has written two books on Talmud. Please welcome our panel. Okay, so gentlemen, we're going to move from one cook to another. We're changing places in the kitchen now. And I want to read to you a comment made by Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook in 1967. And I want you to think about what the implications of this are for religious Zionism. The panel here is Land All There Is, New Directions for Religious Zionism, because many of the perceptions of outsiders is that especially, I think, in the wake of the Hitnatkut, the disengagement, was that religious Zionism had gotten kind of bogged down in a land-based ideology, and it needed to expand or move on and so on. And given that we're exactly 3 weeks away from elections, it's probably timely to revisit some of these issues. So here's the quote, and we'll start with Rabbi Dr. Berkowitz can begin the answer, and then we'll move along. So, just before the Six-Day War broke out, there was a dramatic speech that Rabbi Cook's son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, made. It was actually at Merkaz HaRav Cook in Yerushalayim. And there were many people that night giving speeches, and he was the last one. And here's what he said. He said, 19 years ago, so he's referring to 1947, the partition plan. 19 years ago, when the decision of the establishment of the State of Israel was made by the governors of the nations of the world, when all the people flocked to the streets to publicly celebrate, I could not take part in that joy. In those first hours, I could not make peace with what was done, with the horrible news, that God's words from the prophecy and the 12 prophets, my land was divided, that these words were coming true. Right? So the actual founding of the state based on the partition plan was an unmitigated disaster for him. Okay? An unmitigated disaster. Rav Kook, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, who's Rav Avram Yitzchak Kook's son. Listen to his words. He says, where is our Hebron? Are we forgetting it? Where is our Nablus, Shechem? Are we forgetting it? Where is our Yericho? Are we forgetting it? Where is our east side of the Jordan? Where is every lump and chunk, every bit of dirt? Every bit and piece of the Dalet Amot, the four cubits of God's land, is it up to us to give up any millimeter of it? God forbid. In the state of shock that took over my body, completely bruised and torn to pieces, I could not rejoice then. I was miserable. Everybody in the streets of Israel was thrilled. I was miserable. Now, it's very interesting that some people quite prominent in Israel today were there at that speech. And they were in a state of utter shock, right? Rav Yitzchak Shilat wrote a journal, and in the journal he said, Rav Kook spoke with a rage and a fury that I have never heard before. He kept repeating the verse, and they divided my land, they divided my land, over and over and over again. Hanan Parat wrote, Rav Kook shouted and roared and moaned. We looked at him and saw that he was really like a person crying out over the dead, like something had died. Like a man who had done kriya, who had cut his garment. Okay. Let's begin with this idea and move from there. So, this raises obviously a fundamental question about the relationship between society and land and state. Should Rav Kook's notion be the starting ideal, the starting place for how religious Zionists should think about the land of Israel? And should it be that concessions are made perhaps because of the political structure, but this should be the goal? Is this the central aim of a religious Zionist society? And are there other central aims that come along with it?
Okay, good morning. Thank you very much. I'm going to begin with a story. I remember about 34 or 5 years ago when Menachem Begin was elected Prime Minister of Israel. And it was the first time, and I hope to have more to say about this, that the socialists were out of power. And Mr. Begin came to the United States, as is often the case for new prime ministers. And on Sunday morning, you know, the whole world isn't like Israel, and most of the world's Sunday's a day off, and we hope to get there here too. But on Sunday morning, Begin was on the talk shows, the news shows, and it happened to be Tisha B'Av. And the newscaster had no idea about Tisha B'Av, and he asked a question. And I remember Begin listened to the question, and then he said, excuse me, I would like to say something first about the importance of the day, and he spoke about Tisha B'Av. With your permission, without addressing the question first, I would like to say something first about the presentation that we heard before about Yeshayahu Leibowitz. I mean, I have nothing, whether Yeshayahu Leibowitz can or cannot be put up as the alternative to Rabbi Kook. I just feel compelled morally to share with you the following information about Yeshayahu Leibowitz. In the state of Israel, no street is permitted to be named after Yeshayahu Leibowitz in any city at all. And the reason for that is because he called the settlers of Judea and Samaria, he called us Judeo-Nazis. And so when you call Jews Nazis, it's something to bear in mind. Now to address your point. The issue of, whether the religious Zionists or Rabbi Kook or his son Rav Tzvi Yehuda, is land all that there is? I mean, you know, I would like to begin with a cynical comment, and that is to say, no, of course land is not all that there is. There's also money and power, and we hope to have it all someday. But in all seriousness, my initial response is, and I listened to what Elliot said, in his presentation, my initial response is that it's really not about land. And, a part of me believes that a more proper reading of Rabbi Cook would lead to a different kind of conclusion, that he wasn't really what we call, what political scientists call, a dirt worshiper. And we, the religious Jews, we're certainly not dirt worshippers the way the socialists were. And I think there was a lot of confusion in the religious Zionist community in the early days of the Zionist movement and of the state about the value of compelling the earth to give forth its fruit, which of course is valuable, but it's not political. The real issue here has to do with boundaries. It's not about settlements. It's not about where you live and who lives there. It's about boundaries, or to put this in more common formulation, it's about sovereignty. It doesn't matter who lives within the boundaries of the United States of America, or who lives within the boundaries of Canada. What matters is who is the sovereign over that area. Who is the sovereign over those people? And the truth is, this dispute goes back to the very early days of Zionism. There was always a debate between the socialists, the socialist Zionists, and the revisionist Zionists. The socialist Zionists believed that it was a question of demography, of how many Jews will we have? And it didn't matter what made you Jewish or not. The question was one of demography, and of course, unfortunately, this notion has been exported from the left into the religious Zionist community, and especially into the settler community, where we think it's about Jews versus Arabs. Of course, those who live in Judea and Samaria know that we Jews and Arabs can get along very well. And the question is really one of sovereignty. Who is going to be the sovereign? So is there more to the question of land? Of course. It's not about land. It's not about who lives where. It's only about one question. Who will be the sovereign? And, I want to give the other panelists a chance to speak. I see Elliot took his mic already. But I'm sure that Rabbi Cook understood this as well, as I hope to show the next time I get a chance to speak. Thank you very much.
I want to thank Torah in Motion for inviting me to speak, and we're very pleased that Torah in Motion is really in motion and coming to Israel. So it's nice to have you here, Ba'aretz. I also want to start with a little story about Yishayahu Leibowitz and Rav Cook, because putting the two together is quite unusual. And the story I heard is from Avi Ravitsky, who many of us know is an important political thinker here in Israel, who mentioned that he was once on a panel or some sort of Yom Iyun similar to this with Yishayahu Leibowitz. And obviously, Yishayahu Leibowitz was not a fan of Rav Cook's thinking, even though he admired the man personally. And Avi Ravitsky was speaking about Rav Cook, and he said that, according to my esteemed colleague, Yishayahu Leibowitz, it must be difficult to understand how Rav Cook could have ever said Havdalah, because after all, everything is holy, so what do you mean? And he saw a big smile appear Yishayahu Leibowitz's face, and he was enjoying. And then he continued, Avi Ravitsky continued and said, however, for Yishayahu Leibowitz, I'm not sure I could ever say Kiddush. So there's more to Yishayahu Leibowitz, in fact, than meets the eye. I think what's interesting is the notion that Yishayahu Leibowitz is an alternative within religious Zionism is questionable. Yishayahu Leibowitz, I think, saw himself as a Zionist and as a religious person, but where there was interface between the two is less clear. What I want to do is to contextualize the thinking of
Rav Kook in terms of the present discussion. There was and there is an alternative to Cookian thinking. Pre-1967, the religious Zionism was really dominated by the non-Cookian elements, the more practical, less ideological, less idealistic approach to Dat Medina, to religion and state, which held that, in fact, the Zionist movement was a good way to save the Jewish people, that there was a Jewish problem. Anti-Semitism in Europe was on the rise, certainly, obviously, before World War II and through the Holocaust. And religious Zionists teamed with secular Zionists to address this problem. And they felt, from a practical point of view, there would be a national culture. And in fact, Mizrahi was formed in order to address that. There was a division between the secular cultural Zionists and the religious cultural Zionists, because there would be a Jewish culture. The only question was what that culture would be made up of. And that was pretty much the dominant ideology within the Mavdal up until 1967. In 1967, you saw, partly because of the historical events, a dramatic change where Rav Kook's ideology was popularized. Now, what happened is it was a particular version of Rav Kook's ideology, as you said, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook's version, which emphasized one aspect, which actually was less addressed in your introductory comments, because Rav Kook was very much focused on the body for the sake of the soul, meaning the state, the land, in order to propagate a mystical vision, which, by the way, I think had very practical ways of being a light unto the nations. I don't think Rav Kook simply felt that this was God pulling the strings, as much as there was a practical ideological vision that would come from a new Jewish culture that Rav Kook envisioned.
I'm just going to pop in here for a sec. If that's the idea, in other words, if the idea of settling the land for the state, in other words, the body for the soul, wouldn't we say that on some level, not that it's an abject failure, but that it certainly has not taken hold particularly, what does that mean then? In other words, if this whole experiment to do this thing called Zionism is ultimately to make Israelis spiritually conscious, religiously conscious, whatever sort of phrases you want to use, where are we left with that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think certainly my understanding of Rav Kook, and I'm more of a student of the other vision of Rav Kook, which is follows the Nazir as opposed to his son, which is the other line of thinking, which is more universalistic and focused on spirit, etc. I think the fault is not so much in where we are today, or the problem is not where we are, but the fact that that vision of Rav Kook was dominated by a different vision, and it's not something that's lost, it's simply it's not been developed. I think with the Hitnatkut and with the understanding that land is not all there is, that there is a renaissance and a focus on other ways of thinking with Rav Kook. I just want to point out that my son went to yeshiva in Tel Aviv, Rav Chaim Gantz's yeshiva. Rav Chaim Gantz is an interesting person. He's definitely a right-wing politically and a student of Rav Tzvi Yehuda. But what he's done, I think, epitomizes what should be done in many, many more ways, and that is that he was someone who was Rosh Yeshiva, a Magid Shiur in Hebron, and he saw that as the vision. Now, for the last 15, 20 years, he set up a yeshiva in Tel Aviv where the focus is much less on the land but on the people. I suggest that really that is the ultimate focus of Judaism. Is, you know, the land is powerful, but the people is more powerful still.
Thanks. Okay, I also thank Dr. Malama for the kind invitation. All right, I'm going to be a bad boy, okay? You know, Rav Kook was not only a once-in-a-generation Talmud Chacham, but also a great tzaddik with a poetic soul. And Yeshaya Leibovich, let's face it, he was a cranky old guy who said nasty things, one of which Avi just quoted. You know, the popular thing to do is to say, of course, Rav Kook was right. Leibovich was a creep. But no. Okay, I'm going to take Leibovich's side of this debate, with your permission.
You're not going to say that Rav Kook is a creep, I hope. You know,
I'm not going to say Rav Kook is a creep, no. I will say this, okay? Let me put things as starkly as possible, okay? I'm not a religious Zionist, okay? Let me explain what I mean by that. I'm religious. I'm a Zionist. I live in Efrat. I work in Bar Ilan. My kids go to Hesder and Sheirut Lumi. I'm a poster boy for what you might think of as religious Zionism. However, Yosef Burg once said that in the phrase Dati Le'umi, the most important thing is the hyphen between them, okay? The point being that even in Burgani Zionism, as opposed to Cookian Zionism, okay, one is supposed to view one's religious commitments as being colored by Zionist commitments and vice versa. One's Zionism has to be deeply informed by one's religious commitments. Yeah, that sounds good. It's the kind of pap that you hear in yeshiva and so on. I think that's nonsense. I'm religious independent of my Zionism. I would be religious even if I were not a Zionist. I was religious before I was a Zionist. And my Zionism, in the sense of thinking that Jewish sovereignty is a good thing, is entirely independent of my religious commitments. There are many people who are good Zionists who are not religious, so obviously one can be Zionist without being religious. The notion that the two things have to be connected, I think, has led only to bad results. Now, with regard to the...
Can you clarify that? What bad results?
I'll clarify exactly. So first of all, let me just say, with regard to the cosmic question, okay, of does a sovereign Jewish state in Israel somehow change the cosmos, okay? Does it have some profound meaning for the world, et cetera, et cetera? I'm completely agnostic on all cosmic questions, okay? I don't know the answer to that. I'm not going to argue with Rav Kook about that. I that would be presumptuous in the extreme. On the other hand, I'm not going to even agree with him because I know nothing about cosmic issues. I'll let the Rabbeinu Shalom run the world. I'm only thinking about public policy questions here on Earth. In terms of public policy questions here on Earth, the conflation of religion and Zionism fundamentally has two consequences. One is that one sees historical events such as Israel taking over Yehuda v'Shomron in 1967 is part of a redemptive process which we can presume to understand, and consequently this should reflect on our policies with regard to Yehuda v'Shomron. My feeling about that is that we should do what makes sense in Yehuda v'Shomron. It happens that my opinion is that we'd be complete morons for completely political reasons to make any compromises in Yehuda v'Shomron, but that's a political view. It's unrelated to my religious view. The moment you make that into a religious view, and because you believe that the redemptive process has to be a one-way street, and we have the map, you're bound to do stupid things.
Okay. Can I just quick follow-up there?
Yeah.
So if, theoretically, let's say, if one could trust it, all Palestinians, Gaza, West Bank, every gun gets laid down. We are no threat to you whatsoever. Would that actually trigger a crisis in religious Zionism? Because what you're doing is you're kind of hiding behind the political fact that you can't trust them, so of course you can't compromise on the land. But if you could trust them, what would then happen?
My view is entirely political. I have no religious view on that whatsoever. I think religion is irrelevant to it. And by the way, I want to point out that lest you think that would always put me to the left of a Fabrenta Kuknik, the opposite is actually true. Okay? I'm a right winger because I'm a right winger. If you take somebody like Yoel Ben Nun, who's a Fabrenta Kuknik, say Yoel Ben Nun, because of some complicated theological calculation in which the will of the people in Israel reflects some higher cosmic reality, now thinks that we should be making compromises in Yehuda v'Shomron, except for Hityeshvut, which has its own theological implication. Because of some complicated theological, he therefore thinks we should be making compromises, okay? I think that theological considerations should neither suggest compromises nor not compromises. I think that they're entirely irrelevant to public policy questions. That's one item. Now there's another area which that would take us a little.
We're just going to run back here. He's raised the issue. Do you think religious considerations should have any place in public policy?
Okay. Can I secularize this discussion? Because in the introductory remarks, it was said that Rabbi Cook recognized that the secular Zionists were anti-religious, but he imputed to their activities some kind of spiritual value that they themselves did not recognize, and Moshe just said that this is cosmic and so on. Now, there's nobody less cosmic and religious that I know of than Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. And Friedrich Engels wrote in a brilliant essay that any social movement that does not recognize its origins is destined to turn into its opposite. And there is absolutely no difference on the practical level between what Rabbi Cook said about the secular Zionists and what Friedrich Engels pointed out about all social movements. Secular Zionism has indeed turned into its opposite, just as Rabbi Cook imagined. And let's not get involved in the nitty-gritty of Zionist politics. Secular Zionism believed that it was going to liberate the Jewish people from their heritage and traditions. And they were wildly successful in building a Jewish state. And the state of Israel has turned into its opposite. It is the instrument which keeps the most assimilated Jews in the world attached to their Jewish tradition. So we need to, you know, make a distinction between what we want to run away with and say, oh, this is cosmic, and let's re-anchor ourselves and say it's secular and political. The idea that religious Zionism, that you can be religious and not a Zionist, or that you can be a Zionist and not religious, and therefore a man who's religious and a Zionist, you can vote for Likud if you want, but the idea is that the most important thing is the hyphen, I think is very, I'm sorry, wrong-headed, okay? It's taking you in the opposite direction. The idea about creating a Jewish state in the land of Israel, about asserting Jewish sovereignty up to the biblical boundary line, again, my view, it has nothing to do with settlements. We have to have sovereignty, but we don't want to compel Arabs to leave the land. We are the sovereigns. We are not the masters. The idea that you can be a religious Zionist or a religious man and a Zionist and not recognize that this is fundamental to a redemptive, secular, political, but a redemptive program for the world, I think is short-sighted. The idea that the modern world exists based on the principle of territorial boundaries that are drawn in a way indistinguishable from a cartographer drawing a map. If I can have another 2 minutes, since I'm sitting next to a Canadian, I love this example. I was once an American. Hopefully someday you'll be able to say the same thing, that you were once a Canadian. What is the difference between us? You speak English, I speak English. You're modern Western, I'm modern. What makes you a Canadian and makes me an American? Okay, I like hockey too, okay?
I actually don't like hockey.
Me so. Neither.
It's neither here nor there.
It's a rhetorical question.
I understand.
The answer is very simple. You were born on that side of the boundary line or lived there, and I lived south of the border. You live north of the border, and I live south.
But surely
of the
you
border.
Don't believe that. Surely,
absolutely.
You, no. Surely,
that's all there is.
Surely
an American,
you are,
no. An American is somebody who lives inside of the territorial boundaries of the United States of America. It doesn't matter if you're white or yellow or black. If you speak English or Spanish or Yiddish or German or anything, an American is defined by his territorial boundaries. Yes, I could have run for president of the United States. My mother could not, because she was not actually born there. But otherwise, there's no cultural, legal or any other issue that makes you an American, except for the question of your boundaries. By the way,
over here aren't American this year.
Why aren't they American?
Because they're not inside
they're
not of the national boundaries.
There, but they're still there.
So anybody who leaves the country stops being that identity?
In the rest of the world, nations believe that their identity is forged by their language. You'll move here, you'll see that's a big factor. What language do Americans speak? They openly admit that they speak the language of another nation. They speak English because America is completely determined in an abstract, artificial manner by its territorial boundaries. Now, this idea comes from Judaism, from the Hebrew Bible. And that is what I believe Rabbi Cook meant by both the dialectic and also by the great contribution that we have to make to the world and to world peace. And when the principle of boundaries becomes recognized as the source of legitimation throughout the world, and nations will cease having to define themselves as being natural, but will recognize that they're all completely artificial. Artificial the way America is artificial, artificial the way the Hebrew Bible lays it out, then in fact we will make a contribution to world peace exactly the way Rabbi Cook imagined it.
I just want to say, Avi, that your proof from Marx and Engels, I don't know who that helps, but I just want to point out that it's not a coincidence that you found a ton of the Messiah for Rav Kook and Marx and Engels. Rav Kook was directly influenced by Marxist thinking, Hegelian thinking, Herder, this idea of the spirit of the nation merging with the spirit of the land, you know, all capital letter, you know, capitalized, the first letter of all of these spirits and lands and homelands and nations, okay? It's weird stuff, okay? It's weird stuff. It was fashionable. It was fashionable at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, and it's weird stuff. If you want to defend Rav Kook, you know, by telling me, yeah, he's really in tune with Marxist and Hegelian thinking, that's great, but you're not convincing me, okay? The
what am I trying to convince you of?
I'm not exactly certain, but in any event. Let's break down into very practical terms what the consequences of the Cookian influence on religious Zionist thinking is with regard to public policy matters, not with regard to the nature of the cosmos. Okay, apart from the issue of Yehuda v'Shomron and so forth and borders. Okay, boundaries. Okay, all of which I have no problem with that because I'm in favor of security, and I think that in this case. Wider boundaries are better for security. I don't trust the Arabs to make peace. Okay, the whole thing is a non-starter.
Okay.
For
Can I just interrupt? Yeah. In other words, yeah. you would be against giving away the Sinai. I'm for it because it's not about security. It's about the idea of artificial boundaries, of artificially constructed boundaries that don't have anything to do with natural frontiers or defense policy.
I don't want to argue whether or not it's wise to give away the Sinai Act. It's a political question. Whatever is better, okay? That's not the point. But let me talk about something that isn't territory-related, on which religious Zionists seem to have a view which is completely wrong-headed, in my opinion, okay? And that is religious Zionists think, well, a Jewish state is a good thing, so therefore more Jewish state, that is big government, is even better. Okay, they think that every single problem that Jewish society or Israeli society has is best solved by getting the state involved. If the price of real estate is too high because there's not a lot of it, okay, and a lot of people want it, especially in Tel Aviv, the solution isn't free markets. The solution is subsidies and regulation. Okay, now religious items are the worst statists in this country, because for them statism isn't only policy, it's religion. It's one has a theological commitment to statism. Okay, when they believe in the welfare state, not because they think it's good economic policy, but because the state has to solve every problem. Whatever problem was solved by communal institutions in the diaspora now has to be solved by the state. But you know what? There are communities in Israel, too, that can solve their own problems without state intervention, but they don't want to, because they've been conditioned to believe by religious Zionist thinking that the state owes them a solution to every single problem. When I came to Israel, when I first came to Israel way back in the 70s, I went to the Gush, I discovered a few things. The first thing I discovered was that Israelis were self-reliant. Okay, whenever something needed to get done, an American's first thought was, where do we find the shagits who's supposed to do this? Okay, and the Israelis would just do it. Okay, so I said, wow, you know, that's really cool. Israelis are self-reliant. And then I discovered something as I was in Israel a little bit longer, and that is, no, Israelis are not self-reliant. They're self-reliant with regard to certain things, but they expect the state to solve all of their problems, okay? When you try to raise money for a shul, okay, you're a rabbi of a shul, try to raise money for the shul, okay? You go to Americans and say, we need money for the shul, we need money for the mikveh, we need money for anything, and they say, of course, it's our communal obligation to give to these things. You go to an Israeli and they say, well, the Misrad HaDatot is supposed to pay for that. The Otsar is supposed to give money for that. They think the state has to solve every single problem we have. And that is a direct outgrowth originally of Zionist thinking. That was Mamlachtiyut. And then it got converted to religious Zionism. Now it's called Mamlachtiyut, okay, in Kupnik thought. But it's the same silly idea. Secular Israelis are able to get over it, because they're not religiously attached to the principle, okay? So they're slowly getting over it. But religious Zionists can't get over it because they have a religious commitment to statism.
I'm just going to cut in and bring Francis into the, Rabbi Natuf into the discussion. Just taking off on what something that Professor Capel said, I guess from your point of view, how much should, broadly speaking, religious values affect public policy in this country? And I just want to broaden the question a little bit. Because it seems just a tad paradoxical, right? If we say that we're living in a Jewish state, and this is, you know, this is the rhetoric that's even claimed by government figures, will say things like this. So do we then sever completely that rhetoric from public policy? We're living in a Jewish state, but Judaism will have nothing to do with public policy. That's one extreme. Another extreme would be, we live in a Jewish state, so Judaism should imbue and inform sort of all sectors of public policy. And then there's the tricky, detail-oriented compromise where we're going case by case. And if we're going case by case, then what's the criteria? That's what I'm really trying to get to. What is the criteria for saying Judaism should play a role for what happens in this country? Like, so because the North American model, obviously, is that everything is privatized, right? Going back to the founding fathers. So if you want to do something religious in America, if you want to worship a turtle, that's fine. You can worship turtles. But you have to worship turtles in your basement, right? You can't do it in the public sphere. We don't want a giant picture of a turtle by the Lincoln Memorial. So that's the way it got solved, is that it got privatized. But if you're talking about a Jewish state, the question is whether you're going to adopt a fully North American model and privatize religion, in which case, what are we talking about when we're talking about a Jewish state?
So the notion of national character is a very complicated notion, which has by no way been resolved in North America. It's not been resolved in Europe, and it's not about to be resolved here. I think it's much more complex than my colleague, Dr. Capel, has presented it, and the notion that it can be sanitarily separated, that religion would be privatized, as far as I'm concerned,
that's not my view.
Okay, so you'll clarify it, but were that to be your view, it would be a non-option. The truth is that Israel is doing something much more profound than what you have in other nation stage, which is recreating a civilization. I think that's what Rav Kook was speaking to. Would he be disappointed? Perhaps. He wasn't the only one who was thinking in such terms. If you look at the writings of Echad HaAm, also very much thinking along these lines. So, and interestingly enough, he also, like Rav Kook, thought that a lot of Jews were not self-aware that he spoke about Jewish
artists and writers in his time working within Russian culture and American culture as still being essentially Jewish. So that essence, which I think as religious Jews, as cultural Jews, as Jews that see a future to the Jewish idea, the Jewish nation, perhaps large N and large I, I think also the notion that Hegel is somehow weird is a bit out of place. I mean, if you ask Francis Fukuyama, who's a recognized scholar and clearly Hegelian, as many others are. And the notion that anything mystical or idealistic is something that we can't grasp, I think, is not so helpful in certainly in a Cookian line, but in other lines as well. But I just want to ask Professor Kappel whether halakha does play a role if you're going to take a more narrow vision of the Jewish idea, which I do not espouse, but if one would separate Jewish theology from Israeli politics, do we also separate Jewish law? And does halakha have no role in determining whether we can, never mind what it says, but does it have no role in determining whether religious Jews should support such things as hitnatkut, whether giving land back to non-Jews is acceptable according to halakha, and assuming that it is not, I mean, again, there's discussion on both sides of the equation, but assuming that it is not, then what should the position of a religious Jew in Israel be?
Okay, I'll answer that. So the general question is, what role should religion play in Israel, and how should religion influence policy in Israel? There are, Francis, you heard this from me recently, so don't be bored, but everybody else hasn't. So let me just say that there are four potential ways in which religion could play a role in Israel. The first of them is by far the most important and also the least controversial, which is the mere fact that you put lots of Jews in one place and give them independence is going to lead to ferment and interesting things are going to happen and Jewish Israeli culture is going to evolve in interesting ways, and I think that's by far the most important one, and probably the one that Rav Kook would have regarded as most important as well, and I think that's completely non-controversial. The second one is that the state is Jewish in the sense that its symbols, its language, its calendar, and so forth are Jewish. I think that's largely non-controversial simply because you have to have a language, you have to have a calendar. There's no reason it should be the Christian one or the Muslim one. If it's a Jewish-majority country, surely it should be Jewish. And I think that's important and non-controversial. But now let's get to the two areas that are controversial. One of them is whether you could have an established religion. That is in the sense of having a state-sponsored rabbinate so that and give that rabbinate certain exclusive powers. That's one. And the other one is that when you regulate the public square, as any government must regulate the public square in some way, okay, I prefer they regulate it as little as possible, but it must be regulated in some way, one can take into account Jewish religious sensibilities. Now, with regard to that, with regard to what I call religious legislation, okay, obviously, if you can outlaw selling whale blubber because you want to save the whales, you can also outlaw. It's no less problematic from a freedom point of view, from a liberal point of view, to say that we want to outlaw the sale of pork because that's offensive to Jewish sensibilities. I don't get this idea where the separation of religion and state means that you're allowed to legislate on the basis of any ism in the world, feminism, socialism, environmentalism, whatever you want is legitimate. Only Judaism is illegitimate. That I find completely idiotic, okay? I there's absolutely no rational defense for that view whatsoever, and I reject it completely. Now, the question is, do I want to outlaw the sale of broccoli because somebody is worried that they might find bugs in it? You know, you can take this too far, okay? And you can take it too far in the sense that ultimately you may find that if you have the power to legislate that kind of thing now because it's important to you, you may find yourself out of power in a few years and somebody else is going to be legislating something that is deeply offensive to you because basically he said, look, what the hell, if you have the power, go for it, okay? So I think it's just a bad idea to grab everything you can just because you have the political power to do it, because you're going to get it back, okay? So probably we're best off calling a truce, and which means basically we need to decide how important is this to us, how offensive is it to other people, and then...
You're talking specifically on a case-by-case basis.
So with regard to legislating religion, the answer is it goes on a case-by-case basis. It depends on how important it is to you.
And the last one?
And the last one is establishment of religion, which is state rabbinate. If anybody can think of a single positive thing that has come out of state-sponsored and regulated rabbinate in this country, I want to hear about it. Okay, and if there's time in the rest of the discussion, I'll give you all the reasons why I think it's a terrible idea.
I just want to back you up. I know you're becoming the centerpiece here, but I will try and change that. I think what you said before, I have to vigorously disagree with. You said that you were speaking about mamlachtiyut. And essentially, I think what you've done is that you've conflated mamlachtiyut with socialism. We who live with the settlers, come from the United States and the Western world, we need to grasp that the grave mistake of the religious Zionists, and whether Rabbi Cook was part of this or not part of this is really not important, was that they completely solidarized themselves with labor Zionism. They became infatuated with compelling the earth to grow, to produce its bounty, and they focused on land rather than on boundaries. And of course, I think this was the great mistake of the religious Zionist movement. They should have solidarized themselves with Jabotinsky, and I am absolutely convinced that had Rav Kook lived to meet Menachem Begin, it would have been clear that religious Zionism's sympathy belongs with the revisionists and not with the socialists. So it's not mamlachtiyut, which is a wonderful thing, but it's socialism that doesn't allow them to move forward from all of these ideas. And socialism is not really part of the Jewish agenda. As regards the other matters, I believe that it's very important, once you understand that the state is about its boundaries, boundaries is about sovereignty, there are very, very few things that the state really has to take under its purview. There is the question of not violating the boundaries, of course, and that, of course, means national defense and foreign affairs, and a few other matters having to do with your identity and your culture. I believe that no official of the State of Israel should ever be permitted to violate the Shabbat in public. He or she should not be permitted to eat pork or non-kosher food in public. But most of these matters are much better dealt with at the subnational level. You know, we who come from the United States, we understand that there's the federal government, and then you have the state governments. At the subnational level, you allow people to have all kinds of different ideas that don't challenge your sovereignty. Not every single issue has to be a question of the future of the Jewish state. The future of the Jewish state is safe and secure. Our neighbors are all disintegrating into a welter of civil war and bloodshed. So we're safe. We're fine. The future, the question has to be, at what political level can we best express our cultural identity? And if I could just give one example. You know, I live in Efrat, so I have a lot to do with the local Palestinian Arab population, and they're very, very nice. And I realized a while ago that, you know, the Muslims have their holidays. And the State of Israel, obviously, as the sovereign expression of the Jewish people, really can't recognize those holidays. But we, the citizens of Israel, at the subnational level, we really could. And I suggested this to a forum that I spoke. I said, you know, when I lived in New York City, we used to wait for all the holidays to come out, so alternate side of the street parking, I don't know if you all know what that is, would be suspended. And, you know, when the Muslims have their Eid, or today is January 1st, it's a Christian holiday. You know, here in Yishi, of course, there's no charge for parking. But, you know, in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, wouldn't it be a wonderful idea for the municipalities at the subnational level to suspend parking regulations for this day so that at a completely secular level, we can all participate with each other's holidays, and we will look forward to the Muslim and Christian holidays and whatever other religions they have here, and they look forward to our holidays, so we all benefit a little bit without having it challenge our identity, our sovereignty, and most importantly, the need for us to be in control over all of the land of Israel, up to sovereign control over all of the land of Israel, up to the biblical boundary line.
I want to return, and then a few minutes I'd like to throw it open for questions from the floor. Let's go back to this notion of case-by-case basis, and I want to address this to all of you. I'm still struggling to find out what would be a set of criteria, say for a religious Zionist or even not for a religious Zionist, to say that something, you used words like offends people's sensibilities. We all know that many things offend many people's sensibilities, and that it ends up sort of descending into this maelstrom of subjectivity. I'm thinking here about larger national notions. In the last year, for instance, the lapsing of the Tal law and the idea of drafting Haredim into the army, which remains, it seems to me as an outsider, but remains quite a thorny problem. And quite a thorny problem that intersects with what we're talking about here, right? Because if you speak to, as I have, many Haredim who will argue, again, I'm not here to argue one way or the other, the Torah to Umnato approach, and who say that this offends deeply my core religious sensibilities about value of Limud HaTorah and so on and so forth, and you're taking away our boys at their core learning power at a certain age, and you're thrusting them into this thing. So it's obvious what we could argue on the other side, that there's a responsibility of every citizen to engage in the national defense, etc. But what I'm pointing out here is everybody is going to give very solid argumentation from their perspective on why their religious values should influence public policy, which leads to chaos, right? Because everybody's got a point of view. Now, if you're actually going to say how much should Jewish values affect state policy, doesn't it behoove us to actually have a set of principles that we can say, well, this crosses the line, this doesn't cross the line? And you'll remember, all of us will remember that years ago it was things like public transport on Shabbat and as you said, selling pork and so on and so forth. This seems endless to me. How do we decide in a Jewish state what role Jewish values should play in the thornier areas of public policy? Because I think all of us would agree with your initial propositions that are less controversial. Anybody can answer this.
The obvious thing is there are value disputes not only in a Jewish state. Every state has value disputes. There's something called a legislature. People sit there, they debate the points, and then they vote. That's exactly the way we ought to be deciding those issues here. I don't think we need any a priori principles that have to guide us. I think that if there are disagreements in society about fundamental value questions, you elect representatives, they debate the issues, they reach compromises, there's some log rolling, and they come to some conclusion.
But is that actually operating here? Let's take the example of Haredim in the army. So if you take a Western political model, you vote, minority loses. Right, you see this in the United States now. There's all sorts of people who don't want upcoming legislation to happen. Too bad, you lost.
There's the notion of civil disobedience. I think
right.
That's really what.
Or minority rights. In other words, are we going to look at Haredim as minority rights? The majority is against you, but we're going to protect your minority rights and keep you out of the army. But if you say that, you also have to engage the idea of whether minority rights trump the idea of national defense. In other words, you were citing a kind of strict political democratic model. I don't see that actually operating here. So something else must be operating here.
No, the Tal law was voted upon by the legislature in the usual political process, and now the legislature is going to find some other compromise using the usual legislative process. The fact that the result isn't exactly the optimal result by one person's view doesn't mean that the legislative process isn't working.
I think the question is not so much how it happens as much as what should we be pushing for, and as what should the religious Zionist community see as those causes, or the Haredi community for that matter, see as causes they should legitimately try to get through the legislature. And the question of drafting of Bachovei Yeshiva, of Yeshiva students, I think is an important case in point, where perhaps the limits of interest articulation are surpassed, where, as Dr. Kapel said before, that if you push something that's completely self-interested, then the other communities will do the same, which leads to what you have in the United States, an impasse where it's a lose-lose situation. I think that's the problem. If I can hijack the question, I just want to address something else that hasn't been touched upon at all, and that is the Kukian vision. I mean, you mentioned Rav Yoel Ben-Nun, but it can actually be a much more politically leftist vision as well. You have Rav Menachem Fruman Tekoa that understands, and certainly coming from a Kukian perspective, who understands the Jewish Weltanschauung as to be a much more accommodating one towards the Arabs, and the question of sovereignty for him is much more permeable. And I wonder to what extent the visions that we've explored today are one side of the equation. I feel myself in this unusual position of being to the left politically of people on the
right,
I'm right in the center. I think we're both in the center. But in any case, strongly identifying with the Kukian position and yet taking a different vision of that perspective than is normally.
So can I add to your question? Let's say we put land to the side. Maybe each of us you can define, since you raised it, what do you think should be the central priorities for a religious Zionist community now, outside of land or political considerations? And maybe I can frame the question just by quoting you something from the first ideological platform of Gush Emunim. It says that their goal is to bring about a great movement of awakening in the nation of Israel in order to realize the Zionist vision in its entirety, with an awareness that the source of this vision is the Jewish tradition and the roots of Judaism. Its goal is the Jewish tradition. Its goal is the complete redemption for the nation of Israel and the entire world. Do these goals still exist, and how would they manifest? If we're not talking about land, what are we talking about?
I think one thing that the Mavdal used to understand and that Meretz also understood is that the Ministry of Education is the key portfolio. That if we're looking at the future, we can influence Israeli secular education by making it a priority. Whether Bible is studied, how much it studies, how it's studied, Jewish, beyond Bible, I mean, Tanakh had a place in the Zionist and secular Zionist agenda. Chazal had much less of a place. All these things need to be brought to the secular public, and I think that should be priority number one for our community.
I believe that so much of this discussion is based on the acceptance of the socialist paradigm that exists in this country, which we, at least in the United States, the Americans have no concept of. In other words, education. Who's setting the educational ideals? That shouldn't be set by the central government. Their job is to worry about sovereign issues, boundaries, security, whose picture is on the money. Those are issues of sovereignty. Who's in charge of education? We need a sub-national level. We need, and this will diminish the friction in this country dramatically. Look, the question of the Haredim being drafted, indeed the question of the Haredim altogether is a totally different topic. You can't compare the issue of whether we should draft Haredim to whether we should, allow public transportation on Shabbat. These are just two totally separate issues, and to conflate them, to make believe they're the same, serves only the Haredim. There is a fundamental question whether or not you are a Zionist. And if you're not a Zionist and you don't believe in the Zionist state, do you really have the moral legitimacy to say, I'm taking part in the Zionist government? In a free country, you can say and do whatever you want, but can you really sit in the government if you're not a Zionist? And if you are a Zionist, the conditions are such that you need to be ready to send your children off to the army. And let's be honest, the only reason they don't want to go to the army is because this army fights wars, and in wars people die, and they don't want to die. And everything else is just a cover story. But on the more important issues, the issues that have been discussed, we need to get to the point where we understand it's about sovereignty, it's about boundaries, it's not about education, it's not about transportation, it's about these few issues. Where will the boundaries be drawn? Everything else must be addressed on the sub-national level.
You have questions. So I'd like to throw it open to the floor, and just for the purposes of being heard by everybody, so I will come around with the mic, and you will ask your question. I'm going to ask you to just introduce yourself, your name, where you're from, et cetera, okay, and I will come through here. All right, I'm going to start in the back because I saw your hand first. Say your name. And say you're from Eretz Yitzvi.
Hi, I'm Max. I'm from Yeshiva Eretz Yitzvi. You said very often and spoken a lot about the idea that the issue isn't about loving the soil, it's about establishing sovereignty and boundaries and such. The problem that arises with that is you've got to then work out who has control over this sovereignty of the people that are within these sovereign borders. And for a Jewish state to be established, the fundamental principle of that is that it is a sovereign Jewish state, which then leads to two issues of all the people, the three-fifths or three out of eight people who aren't Jewish, two out of eight are Arabs, who are living in the areas, who will either be somewhat pushed and coerced out of a Jewish state. And secondly, if that's not the case, a sort of discrepancy will arise within a civil system of people within rights and such. And then within a Jewish state, isn't there a concept of all agoyim that we should be a light unto the nations and actually push forward to a greater good?
Okay, I assume the question was for me. If you're asking about, well, what defines the Jewishness of a Jewish state, or are you asking about, well, how can we accept the Arabs into the state because we know they're disloyal? Okay, I'm going to assume that was your second question. Arabs cannot be loyal citizens of the Jewish state. I'm going to tell you a story. In 1959, okay, we're talking a long time ago, the government of the State of Israel passed a law in the Knesset which gave certain hatavot, benefits, to those citizens who served in the army. Now, for the government, they were excluding the Arabs and basically the religious Jews. There was no hesder. The religious Jews didn't go to the army either. And Menachem Begin got up on the floor of the Knesset and he gave an amazing speech in which he excoriated the government for doing this. And he said, how dare you exclude the Arabs from this, from getting these benefits? You are the ones who don't let them serve in the army. You can't say that you're not allowed to do something and then punish them for not serving. The point is as follows. The assumption that Arabs cannot be loyal citizens of the sovereign Jewish state is as corrupt as the racist assumptions that led, I heard your accent, I know you're not from the United States, but as the, where are you from, South Africa maybe? As the racist assumptions that led the white Europeans to imagine that they are superior to the dark-skinned people of the world. This is a false and fallacious assumption. It has nothing to do with Judaism and the Jewish state. Sovereignty is an amazing concept, and people love to be part of the sovereign majority. Let's try it, and you'll see how everybody will get along.
Go ahead, he has a follow-up. Okay. All right.
Hi. My name is Ezra Schoen. I'm from New Jersey. And my question is to Professor Capel. I may have misunderstood some of the things you said, so let that be noted before you hear the question. But I'm a bit confused how you can characterize yourself as a Zionist. At least my understanding of what a Zionist is somebody who strives for a Jewish state. And it sounds to me like you are recognizing the fact that we have a Jewish state today, but you don't necessarily, I guess, appreciate the, or maybe appreciate is the wrong word. You don't necessarily, I guess, want the idea that it should be an only Jewish state. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that I think what you were saying. Is you were saying that it is a Jewish state today, and there's many Jews there, so we should act as a Jewish state. But the fact that it is a Jewish state today is something that happened through a course of events, but it's not necessarily should have been the right path.
Okay, so I completely agree with your first statement. You did misunderstand me. No, as a matter of fact, I am a Zionist. Okay, let me make that clear. I'm a Zionist. I moved from the United States, living a very comfortable life, to Israel because I want to live in a Jewish country. I served in the army. My kids serve in the army and Sheirat Lumi. I also happen to be involved in politics, and one of the things that I do is I write laws, which I then lobby for in the Knesset. One of the laws I wrote is called the Chok Yesod HaBayit, Medinat Yisrael KeBayit HaLumi Shalama Yehudi. Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people. I do believe that the state should have a Jewish character. The question is only how that Jewish character should be manifest. As I said, it includes such things as I think the Jewish character of the state should be reflected in its language, in its symbols, in its immigration policy, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? I think that it should be, there should be religious legislation that creates a Jewish atmosphere in the public square, but it should be very selective because it's part of a political process in which there's also a price to pay. You can't just pass every law that seems like a good idea to you. You have to take into account that other people have different views, okay? And I do think that the state should not be Jewish in the sense that the rabbinate should be a state-sponsored and state-regulated institution. I think that the rabbinate should be privatized. So if that makes me not Zionist, I wear that badge proudly.
Just move over here.
Okay. My name is Hillel Rosenfeld. I live in Ramat Beit Shemesh for 8 years, coming from America. My question is actually based on a concern because, fortunately or unfortunately, I wear more than one hat, and having had both a background as a professor of political science but also working many years as a therapist, we oftentimes are concerned about not just what is said but what is not said. Now, in the introduction earlier, we heard reference to the metaphysical, and then after secular, then we heard reference to the cosmic. So I've heard much dialogue about the subject of public policy, and I'm curious about the concepts in religious Zionism, which I see, by the way, as a kind of a collection of terms, that there isn't a clear synergy and a singular word which would by language explain that. I'm curious about the subject of, within religious Zionism, the individual responsibility of the development of the, quote, metaphysical focus that Rav Kook spoke about, and our role, not just within the boundaries of Israel, but our role as so-called religious Zionists for the more cosmic or universalist reflection of what that means for the world.
I'm not sure I understood the question precisely, but if I did, certainly the thought of Rav Kook is still widely discussed and propagated in many, many yeshivot. As I alluded to before, I think there's a certain type of Kookian thinking which is still very much based in Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, who, after all, was the greatest propagator of his father's thinking. That being said, I think that there are alternative visions of Rav Kook's thought that are also propagated and I think need to be more propagated. What's interesting is perhaps only within the last 10 years you have Cookian outreach programs, which I think are translating Cookian thought into a more universal direction simply because that's what exists outside. And I think in general, we'll get to this in the next panel perhaps, whenever you're in contact with others, with the outside, it enriches yourself. And I think Rav Kook was very, very much aware of that, and that's what enriched his thought in a way that his son's thought was less so, because he was very much enclosed for most of his life within, I mean, he lived in Geula, he lived in within a Haredi environment, and was very much brought up and lived in the world of the yeshiva, which Rav Kook did not. The fact that the Dati Lumi world is moving into outreach and reaching out to the secular and living with the secular, I think will actually have a positive impact on the expression of Rav Kook's thoughts.
I'm Tzvi Wiesel. I'm also from New Jersey. And I had a question for Rabbi Berkowitz, and I apologize for Max if I'm misinterpreting what he was saying, but I don't believe Max was proposing racism as much as if you follow the Cookian thought of returning to boundaries that are biblically set, you will innately have an issue in which a population that is larger than the Jewish population, according to this sovereign idea, will be given the right to vote, in which case if they will no longer allegedly be voting for a Jewish-run government. And if that happens, Israel will either lose its Jewish identity or we will be forced to take measures, in which case Israel will not actually be a sovereign democracy or a place in which the population that we will now have encompassed in our boundaries will be able to vote and live freely.
Okay, I apologize. I didn't mean to suggest that your friend was racist. What I really mean to say is that this whole demographic argument, this is not a new debate. This debate has been going on since the pre-state era. There was always a debate. And, you know, look, my view is set. You're welcome to study and figure out your view. Of course, if you're smart, you'll come around to my view. But that's a separate issue. But there were always two perspectives on Zionism. One was the socialist Zionist perspective. They believed that they're going to build a Jewish state one settlement at a time. Or as when I used to teach my students, I would say I called it the Zionism of cows. They're going to build a Jewish state one cow at a time. Then there was the revisionist perspective. And they said, we're going to create a sovereign Jewish authority, or what I call the Zionism of guns. That there's nothing, we don't need to change the Jewish people, we don't need to redo the Jewish people, all we need to do is arm the Jewish people. And that was successful. Now we're up to today. Do you really believe that the socialist vision of demography, that's a challenge? Demography has been proven to be completely unreliable in terms of projecting future challenges to sovereign entities. I believe, and I'm not metaphysical, but I believe that we have a responsibility to complete the Zionist revolution and extend Jewish sovereignty up to the biblical boundary line. And all the arguments about demography really don't carry much weight. Yes?
Either of you want to, just before you do either of you want to say anything about it? No? Okay. So we have a lot of people, so I'm afraid we're going to have to.
We can talk over.
You're welcome to follow up with everybody at the lunch break. We're just going to go over here in the corner.
My name is Eve Harrow. Isn't it nice to hear a woman's voice? Like, finally. Yes,
Adrat Nashim.
I'm a little confused, okay, and the question is for any of you. I don't know how you can separate religious from Zionism, hyphen notwithstanding. Okay, I don't think Rav Kook or Yishael Leibovitz wrote the Shema or Birkat HaMazon, both of which are odes to the land of Israel. The Hayayim Shamoi, whom everybody said this morning. Okay, and after lunch we'll be benching. Okay, now all of us in this room, by the fact that we're speaking English, whether it's Canada or American English, are products of a Christian environment. Okay, we're all Christian Jews. And so my question is, we are here by virtue of a detour by virtue of a religion that very clearly over the years said that it's grounded in the land of Israel. So I see religious Zionism, and I hope that one of you sees it the same way as pulling it all together, as finding the positive in the religion and the positive in the Zionism and making it work. And maybe now, okay? So my question is that, yes, I do believe also in the separation of church and state for the, but what I'm hearing is a grave focus on land or a grave focus on separating and not the positive elements here that I think is what religious Zionism is supposed to be about, okay? The bridging of the best of both of those worlds. How are we going to be able to do that?
Nobody looks too quick. Nobody looks too quick to pick up on that one.
All right. Everybody, yeah, whatever. What? Oh, okay. So I guess you meant me then, Eve. All right. So it's like this. I agree that religion is a good thing and that Zionism is a good thing, okay? And it's true that the two of them, when they're found together, can magnify the good in each of them, okay? So I concede, for example, if we're talking about public policy, okay, that both religiosity and patriotism, if that's what Zionism is, are civic virtues, okay? And religion and patriotism both encourage other civic virtues, okay? You find in America, right, the you know, evangelical Christians are good citizens, right? They have lots of civic virtues. They're both religious and they're patriotic, okay? So I agree that these are good things. My argument is only that when you interpret your Zionism in a strictly religious way, okay, in a specifically in the Cookian religious way that Dr. Melamed read to us, you are often led, and this is what has happened in practice, to thinking about public policy issues in theological terms. And when that happens, the result is bad, okay? When you make your public policy based on a particular conception of how the cosmos works, in other words, you're not thinking about how this is going to work out down here in very practical terms in a world filled with uncertainty, but rather you think about it in terms of some kind of a cosmic map where you claim to have certainty that we don't have, in fact, on the ground, you're liable to come to policies, whether it's regarding territory, whether it's regarding the role of the rabbinate, or whether it's regarding economic policies that are simply bad for real people in the real country of Israel.
Can I just challenge that for a second?
Yeah. How does that differ from advocating not selling pork because it's offensive to Jewish sensibilities in Israel? Isn't that also based on improvable metaphysical ideas?
No, we all have values on this earth that are rooted in religious ideas, okay? I don't dispute the fact that some of the things I want are a function of my view of the world, okay? So therefore, if I, for example, might advocate for banning the sale of non-kosher food, I don't, by the way, for strictly political reasons, but if I would do so, it's because, yes, it's a value of mine. I think that eating treif is something that I'd rather not see in the public sphere. Pornography is something I'd rather not see in the public sphere. All of these things are related to my religious worldview, and I think it's completely legitimate to advocate for public policy and for defining the public square in a way that's consistent with my values, okay? I'm not saying we have to bracket our values in the way that Rawls would say, right? Take all your values that are based on comprehensive theories, right, which is what Rawls's fancy word for religion, right, and bracket those and only talk in secular terms. I think that's exactly wrong, okay? What I'm opposed to is when people actually make policies based on the way they think history has to play out, because they have a certain theological view of what history has to look like and how the process of Zionism has to play out, okay?
I'm just to reinforce Rabbi Nataf's question, I really fail to see the difference. You say that on a public square, some butcher out in, Cholon
cannot sell pork. Why? Because I have some notion based on the Bible that something about this pig meat is unsound, metaphysically unsound, offensive, whatever adjectives you want to add to this. So you say, we're going to try and strike a public compromise and not do that. But now we say that I, person B, has just as much a conviction about, you know, as this woman, you know, eloquently stated, that it's the warp and woof on the molecular level of our tradition, our texts, that the land is holy, that we should have sovereignty in it. And a number of the students' questions basically got to the conflict between religion and democracy. So what's the difference between my coercing that halon butcher not selling pork and my, you know, saying to that other person, oh, don't inflict your, you know, metaphysical schemes on this country?
Can I defend him?
Sure.
2 points. First
That's
of all,
great. You're defending him. We've come around.
Redemption
is happening.
2 points. First of all, I think part of the problem is that we think of everything as a national issue. That's number one, but I've made that point before. We need subnational significance. But more importantly, as far as pork is concerned, you know, we live in the Middle East. And here in the Middle East, their dominant religion is called Islam. And in Islam, they have Sharia law, which is vast and complex like our halacha, but they also have the pillars of Islam. Now, we don't have that in Judaism. There are 5 pillars of Islam. We don't have pillars, but we do have certain matters that over history have become more significant than others. For example, I'm an Orthodox Jew. I would not want my child to marry someone from who's not Orthodox, right? So if I saw that they were violating the Shabbat publicly and my child wanted to date their child, I would try and discourage them. But if I saw that the father of the young man or young woman was not wearing tzitzit, I don't think it would be of the same quality. Pork has come down as the symbol of what Jewish culinary habits reject. There is clearly a difference between saying that you can't sell pork and saying that, well, you can't, you know, sell a sandwich, you know, that has salami and cream cheese. It's not of the same order. Pork, there are certain things that are symbolic of the Jewish people. Pork is one of them.
This is a much longer discussion. We don't have time. I couldn't agree with you less. I think that everybody arbitrarily reads in what they think is the ultimate significance of which mitzvah and which mitzvah. This is a fantastic topic for another time. Right now, I'd like you to give all these gentlemen a warm hand. So we are now going to break for lunch. I give you full rashut to swarm these gentlemen if you have unasked questions. And we're going to meet back here in a half an hour for our next session. Thank you very much.